Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right here is some of the places where I'd found the material where it had washed down from the hill slopes and against the sides and all down into this sinkhole area, concentrated by the action of erosion.
This is where the runoff came down. So we're talking the impact site. How far would you say up this way that would be?
Okay, so the impact site started basically right at the base of that little hill right there, and it came down this way. It's the furrow, the gouge mark left by the object that was dragging across the ground.
Being here and seeing the actual site, seeing the levels, seeing how everything runs down here, it makes complete sense to me what Frank has come up with. It's perfectly logical.
So it is this arroyo?
Yes, it's this one right here. This is the one where it came in and left the gouge mark. So it skipped the hillside.
You know, I was really skeptical when we first came out, and I expected to see a place where humans were and that you would see evidence of humans. You would see trash. But now that I've been out here, there's no trash. There's no proof that anybody's been out here. So it's really surprising that Frank found metal here.
This is Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Sprague.
Frank Kimbler, welcome, I believe, for the very first time to Somewhere in the Skies.
Oh, hey, no kidding. Missed talking to you before, but not this time. You've got me right here, right in person, right here.
So, right here in the crash site. If you're watching this episode, guys, Frank has a wonderful background for us about what we will obviously be talking about tonight, and that is the Roswell UFO crash, a case near and dear to many people's hearts. But Frank, I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently of UFO crash retrievals, wreckage, this huge story that just exploded into the mainstream, which we will touch on later in the show. However, those are just stories until we actually, you know, see, touch, feel these things that they're talking about. And you are one of those individuals who's actually done that, who's gone out to a UFO crash site and found things and had them analyzed. So we're going to talk all about that tonight, obviously. We're even going to talk about the materials that you handed over to me and I had tested. And the results were, let's just say, interesting. We have developments on that as well. And some new things you found out there at the Roswell crash site. But I'm getting ahead of our entire conversation, Frank. Let's go back. Let's rewind. For those of our audience who may not be familiar with you, what made you want to become a geologist and what actually brought you to New Mexico? Give us the origin story, if you don't mind.
You know what? It's an interesting pathway. We all lead like pathways to certain things. And when I was younger, I didn't really think about being a geologist. I started out being kind of like a pre-veterinary medicine person. But I got interested in the geology side because my parents would take me out. We'd go rock collecting. We loved to drive on old back roads and explore ghost towns and everything in the desert Southwest. And I loved going out panning for gold and looking for things like that. So it was really, that's what led me down that path to be a geologist. And then when I moved out to Roswell was kind of interesting for me. I always loved the stories about Roswell, but I didn't know that much about it. But when I moved out here to work at the New Mexico Military Institute as an instructor, teaching geology, earth sciences for both college and high school, I took a keen interest in doing the Roswell story, and I wanted to apply some of my scientific knowledge to try and find some touchy-feely stuff out there, not just pictures, but some things that might have been left over in 1947.
So I guess my question to kind of play off of that is, did you have any knowledge, foreknowledge of the Roswell UFO crash? I mean, I would imagine moving to Roswell, he must have known something about the case or heard the mythology behind it. What was your interest in UFOs prior to moving to Roswell?
Yeah, interesting thing. Prior to moving to Roswell, it was just films and documentaries like a lot of people have seen before. And I just took more of an interest to it since I moved out here. I'm going, well, this is cool. And yeah, I'll have to admit to this, that it was probably at least 6 months after I moved to Roswell before I went into the International UFO Museum. And I was walking through the museum there. I'm going, you know what, there's lots of eyewitness accounts. There's lots of information here, but there's no physical evidence. And I'm going, oh, I've got a little project that I'm going to be working on since I live here now and I work here. So I spent the time, I bet I probably spent 2 or 3 months sitting in the library, reading every book, watching every blasted documentary that there was on Roswell. And I'm going, you know what, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to use my knowledge as a geologist and some science, and I'm going to see if I can find some debris that was perhaps left over by the military back in 1947. That's the story behind that. It ended up being a quest, looking for it. It's like looking for a treasure, like looking for a lost treasure. You get kind of obsessed with it, and I still am because I want that proof. And then at a younger, when I was long before I moved out here, I was traveling across the United States and I saw a UFO here in New Mexico. It was far up in the sky. A friend of mine, we were camped out at, I'm trying to think of the campsite. It's up by Las Vegas, Ute Lake State Park. It's where we were camping out at. The Ute Lake State Park, we were camped out there, and my friend of mine, we were sitting by the campfire, and he says, hey, Frank, he says, look at that. And I looked up in the sky, and I says, oh, that's a satellite. You know, you see them all the time, little point of light just drifting across the sky. He says, no, watch what it does. And I watched it for about another 15 or 20 seconds, and this thing made a perfect zigzag across the sky. And I'm going, it was making right angle turns, and then it disappeared over the horizon in the blink of an eye. And I'm going, oh, just saw my first UFO. So that was pretty exciting. And I think since that time, I've had an interest in UFOs. I know that a friend of mine was into Project Blue Book when I was like 12 or 13 years old, 14 years old, whatever. I really enjoyed looking over, he subscribed to various UFO magazines when they were really popular, and I just got into it at a young age. It's fascinating.
Tell me about it. Yeah. Age 12 for me, brother. So I'm getting up there in ufology. I'm no longer one of the young guns, as they call them, but that is what it is. Okay. So you moved to Roswell. You hear the story, you start going out. How did you find the site? I mean, you know, my first time being out there was in 2018 with you. And let's be honest, I mean, throughout the decades, there have been, you know, rumors of where the site was. People say it's here. People say it's there. This, that. How did you personally triangulate or find the actual crash site? I'd love to hear how that process went.
Okay, so it's well noted as to where it is now. It's documented fairly well. However, back when I started, it wasn't well documented as to its location. So what I did was I watched some documentaries, especially that and read about the the two Sci-Fi Channel digs that were out there, and I read the documents that were related to that. And they didn't give any locations to it, but they made one tragic mistake. They put some pictures in there, some aerial photographs. And so being a geologist and knowing how to look at aerial images and such, what I did was, I call it back engineering. In fact, this picture that you're seeing right here, which actually helps a lot, that was one of the pictures that I originally saw. And I took that image, and it took me a day or two to sort of triangulate where it was out there, and then I had it. Once I zoomed in with Google Earth, is a marvelous piece of research material, but I was able to zoom in on the site and find the exact location. And then the researchers like Don Schmidt verified it for me that I was actually in the right place. So that was the hard part. It didn't take me long to find it. And then I just went out, I just went out there and started exploring is what I did. So,
right. Well, and you know, the image you're seeing here, and if you're just listening to this episode, guys, I would highly suggest watching the YouTube version. I do have visuals tonight, because Frank, this is a screenshot of the television show Mysteries Decoded that you and I took part in. Yeah. And, this was at your military institute. And this is you showing me these topographical and aerial shots. And if I remember correctly, another interesting bit to this, how you kind of discovered this, there was two images you showed us. One, I believe, was from something like 1946, and then I think 1952. 54. And there was a 54, excuse me. Yeah. Thank you. And there was a huge difference between the two that kind of led you to also believe that this could be the site. Is that something you could share with us?
Oh, absolutely. Looking at, before I went out there, I did lots of investigative work, of course, and I compared the 1946 images with the 1954. I couldn't get anything after 47 other than the 54. So the comparing the two images side by side led me to believe that there was definitely some disturbances out there and that was worth taking a look and sort of honed in on the specific area because of what was showing up in the pictures.
This image right here is from 1954.
It's the first aerial photo I could find of this area after 1947.
There's something that I kind of honed in this picture pretty fast, and you'll notice this white area right here. There are a series of steps. Can you see the little white steps? The little steps. I refer to them as dozer tracks. It looks like the sharp edges of where bulldozers have come in and sort of scraped the land. The military was cleaning the area up, and they were very systematic. Now, if you come over here on the 1946 picture, that line is gone. So this has been changed between that. The damage that was done to the area happened after 46. Now, what happened to the land between 1946 and 1954? I have actually found metallic artifacts within this area and along the edges of those dozer tracks, small pieces of material.
Those are easy to do when you can compare and sort of flash the images back and forth, same resolution, same size pictures. It's kind of like they do to find planets up in the new planets. That's the way they used to do it. You could flash the images very quickly and watch for very subtle changes and movements on the film. And that's exactly what I did with this.
Right. And then the other interesting thing while visiting the Institute with you that you showed us was this state-of-the-art augmented reality sandbox. Describe this for us. I was stunned when I saw this thing. I think I have an image here. Let me pull that up.
The sandbox is absolutely amazing because you can project topographic landscapes on top of it and draw in the sand and have it recreate the location. So what I did was I built the crash site in the sandbox so that I could show where the object came down and where it traveled to, basically, or not traveled to, but the furrow or the skid marks that it left. And that's it's a fun tool. I use it in my classroom for topography and geology related things. And it gives the students, they go crazy when they see it.
I love it. And again, this kind of showed, you know, for me at least, and you can see the furrows that you've created in this image that we're looking at here of the water and how the runoff would eventually lead anything from the supposed impact site of the Roswell UFO.
The greens and the browns are of course higher ground, and then that light blue is the lower terrain. So it makes it really easy to sort of highlight and show people what's going on.
So what I used to teach a school with here, it's called an augmented reality sandbox, and this is a nice digital representation of the crash site, and you can make it rain simply by holding your hand over the top of it like this. You can make it rain, so you can actually get a picture of how the water actually rolls off the land and where it accumulates, which is what I use to help locate some of the artifacts.
So utilizing this, can you explain the crash site to us?
Oh, absolutely. The object came in out this way, and it came in this direction, and it made what's referred to as a furrow. It spread out kind of in a V shape. And then, according to the eyewitness accounts, there was also a gouge mark. And it's kind of an interesting thing because the metal artifacts that I have found seem to be centered right on the area where the gouge mark is.
How big was this crash site?
This area is probably maybe twice the size of a football field. But the debris was scattered for a distance of more than half a mile.
So you use this, you find what you believe is the site, you go out there. So that's where I think a lot of people out there want to know, what did you go out there with? What sort of instruments or tools did you use to start looking for wreckage, for debris that might have been left behind? Give us an idea of what was your arsenal.
My arsenal of tools. Of course, it was the maps, but I went out, and in fact, this is the location right here. It's just in the background behind me. I went out with a Fisher Gold Bug metal detector. It was an older one. I still use it. The thing is amazing. It was like the second Gold Bug that ever came out. That thing is so powerful and so sensitive that it can detect a BB size gold nugget down to about 3 inches. And I used that exact same metal detector in Arizona and also here in Arizona to find thousands of dollars worth of gold nuggets. So I'm very good at using it. And so I took that out there and I started sweeping all of the runoff areas. In fact, you can see one of the runoff areas directly behind me in this image. So I started sweeping the area with the metal detector. And I got news for you. I was out there for a good solid 6 or 8 hours swinging that metal detector and didn't find a thing until the end of the day. And then I got this beep in my headset because I was wearing a headset at the time and got pretty excited. I was in an anthill. So I dug down about an inch into the anthill and here was this tiny little piece of metal. And the scary part about it is when I held the piece in my hand, I'm going, oh my gosh, is this a piece of an alien spacecraft? It was so lightweight, it blew it out of my hand. And then I had to go and spend another 3-4 minutes trying to find where it had hit the ground. that's a true story. That was the first find, but it was not easy. Like I said, it took 6 or 8 hours of sweeping the metal detector. And I didn't find anything during that time. So my arm was about ready to break off and getting towards the sun was going down. I'm very persistent, very tenacious when it comes to looking for things because I knew something was there. And then I found that piece. And that's what started. I named it AH1, stands for Anthill 1. And that's what started all of this, the whole thing, because then I came back at later times, and that's when I found the buttons. Was following week, following day. I can't remember. That was a long time ago. But I found the buttons. That's them right there, and in these pictures. So the military buttons were found, and there was three of them spaced a couple of feet apart. They have been identified as basically military fatigue buttons dating somewhere between like the late 40s, early 50s. So I know they were out there. This stuff was buried 3-4 inches deep in hard pack clay. So they were old, really, really old. And these are cool. I think this is probably one of the coolest things that I found, which is, you know, if you want to think of smoking guns, you know, military can't say we weren't out there because these buttons are military fatigue buttons. And I found three of them out there. So they were on their hands and knees, maybe digging up stuff, or I don't think they had an orgy out there ripping the buttons off, but there's definitely military buttons. So they were found out there.
Right. Well, and the big thing about this too is I was stunned when you showed me these buttons and you were able to, you know, get them analyzed, that they do date back to when the actual crash happened. I think a lot of people's question is, well, they got everything, they recovered everything, and these things, you know, they would have found everything out there and cleared it. But I mean, come on, for anyone to believe that they got every single tiny piece that was out there, it makes perfect sense, especially when you said these military officers sent out there to clean up the debris site were on their hands and knees. It's very possible so a button or two popped off and they'd never notice. The other big thing is you said that they were found, you know, below the surface. And this would make perfect sense since so much time has passed, right?
Deep. You know what? I don't know whether anyone has ever seen, and I'm sure lots of people have seen pictures of aircraft crash sites. The debris is scattered everywhere, and it makes a mess. And the pieces, yeah, some of the pieces are really big, but some of the pieces are so tiny that they're going to get buried. And you have to understand that back in July of 1947, it was raining, it was storming. Stuff could have been washed down animal burrows, carried down slope, washed into little gullies, covered up by gophers. All kinds of things can happen. And so the idea of the military finding every scrap, I think, is kind of bogus. They could not have found every scrap. So I've been to other types of, like, super secret, sensitive, well, not really secret, but things that were military origin. One of them was the outside of Albuquerque, there was a broken arrow event where on approach, the aircraft, literally the bomb bay door opened up and they dropped a hydrogen bomb basically as they were coming in for a landing just outside of Albuquerque to Kirkland Air Base there. And when that thing hit the ground, of course, if it would have exploded, there would have been no Albuquerque left because it was, in fact, a hydrogen bomb. But it had some detonators on the inside that essentially blew up. It scattered stuff over maybe half a mile or a square mile. Military went out there. They supposedly cleaned it all up. Of course, that was a top secret piece of equipment there. They didn't get it all. Because some acquaintances of mine had gone out to the location, which was documented, and with metal detectors, and they found pieces of the hydrogen bomb. I have pieces of that as well. So they, you know, the government claims to find things, and even the SR-71A crash sites, which was a top secret, you know, spy surveillance plane. When those things crash, they scatter stuff everywhere, and people to this day find stuff with metal detectors. It's you can't not find stuff. If you know what you're doing and you have a good metal detector, you can find stuff. Not an issue.
Right. Right. And so we're going to get to kind of my portion of this investigation with you. But I do want to mention, you know, this area is vast, and I think My investigative partner that looked into this with me, Frank, a Navy veteran, Jennifer Marshall, extreme skeptic, went into this thinking, oh, this kook is going to bring us out to some random part of the desert, and there's going to be Coke bottles out there and beer cans, and that's what he found. But man, we got her on camera literally admitting this is not what I anticipated. I had no idea how remote this area was. No life out there whatsoever. There'd be no reason for anyone to be out there partying, drinking beers, shooting off guns. I know there was ammo found out there at one point, military ammo as well. So, I mean, just going out to the site, man, it changed the mind of an extreme skeptic in my partner almost immediately.
You know, up on the ridge, actually it would be to my, let's see which way it is, to my left. So actually be, yeah, to my left, in the picture, up on the ridge, I was out there with, Hansen, from Factor Faked. And, Ben Hansen, we were out there, with metal detectors, and we, and it's a good distance from this. It's probably quarter, half a mile away. We found, some, snuff cans, tobacco cans up on the ridge. And, some, of all things, a button from coveralls, but they were, modern, around, what appeared to be a camp thing up there. But that was a good distance from this particular site, which is directly behind me. There's nothing out there. There's zero trash, nothing that you can see, that people had been out there. Now, interesting thing, the little white area that is behind me, if looking at the image, if you look to the right, just below that hill, there was something kind of odd back in there. And what was odd is that, and these are old, it looked like somebody had taken several cartons of nails and just scattered them all over the hillside. Now, this is an old trick. It's used to basically throw people off when they're looking for things. I know that when I was hunting gold nuggets, when people would find an area that had some gold nuggets in it, they would frequently go back to keep, if the information got out, they would frequently go back and throw a bunch of nails and odd things in to discourage people from finding anything. So, that's really the only thing that I have found out there that was might be considered trash. But, as far as like the buttons and the little bits of metal, they were buried deep. So it's remote. You can see in the picture. There's not much out there.
Well, okay. So I guess my next question, Frank, would be, before we get to the first initial testing of some of these metals, in total, how many pieces have you uncovered out there at the crash site, to the best of your memory?
Over the years, probably 20 or 30, of which I don't have very much of it remaining, probably less than half, maybe a third of it. Some of it was destroyed during testing. Some of it during the little misunderstanding I had with the Bureau of Land Management. Some things were distributed around the country to make sure that they didn't get taken away. So but I have a little bit of it, yes, in safekeeping.
Okay, good. That's very good to know, because yeah, a lot of people don't understand that for a lot of these tests, things do need to be destroyed, broken down, dissolved in order to do a proper analysis. So it's unfortunate, but that's sometimes the only way to test these sorts of things. Am I correct?
Yeah, no, it is. There are ways to do testing on this material that is relatively non-destructive, but there's only a handful of labs that can actually do it, and it's very, very expensive. NASA is one of them. You can take a tiny little piece of something and analyze all the isotopes in it and everything without really destroying it. The tried and true method is using ICP-MS, and it's a fancy name for basically you dissolve the metals or whatever you want to look for in a liquid, and could be an acid, whatever. And then you put it in the machine and analyze its spectra. You can get down to parts per billion with that. But it's also in the process, you end up destroying the entire specimen while you're doing it.
Yeah. the sacrifice of science, right? Well, okay. I want to get to the first testing of some of your metals, but you mentioned the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. This was a very interesting story that kind of happened. This is actually, I had met you at a UFO conference years prior. However, this was the first time I had seen your name out there, like in national news. And this was because the Bureau of Land Management actually wanted to have a meeting with you and possibly even confiscate some of your material that you had found. Would you mind running us through this story?
You know what? That whole thing, and I'm not going to beat up the Bureau of Land Management, because that whole thing was a misunderstanding more than anything else. They wanted to see it. They wanted to talk to me. I don't believe their intentions were to confiscate the material at all. And I can't beat them up. I think maybe that, well, you've known me long enough to know that sometimes I get a little excited as I get older, I've come to the point where, I try to think through things a little bit. And this was something that, let's just put it this way. I misunderstood their intentions, and they didn't mean to scare me. That's essentially what it boiled down to. So it's all, everything's fine. And it made a big splash because I made a big splash out of it. But if I would have let it alone, it probably would have been okay.
There you go. That's what we need to hear, man. I wish more people would kind of take that very, very, how would you even say it? Mature route when it comes to this, because there's so much conspiracy theory that goes with a lot of this. And look, your involvement with this,
I've made a lot of mistakes, Ryan, and we learn from our mistakes. And one of them is I got to learn not to be quite so hot-headed about some of this UFO stuff and just apply logic and some science behind some of the stuff that I do and kind of think through it before I engage my big mouth.
Welcome to ufology, my friend. I wish more people would use you as an example for that. But besides the BLM thing, there is another sort of conspiratorial angle to a lot of this. You got tests done with some of your materials. And I want to kind of walk through the process of your first test with these and what ended up happening with some of these materials. So, yeah, can you kind of walk us through the first time you got these and got them tested? Yeah, tell us who, what, where.
All right. So the very first test that I had done was on this sample called AH1. And the AH1 sample, I basically contacted the New Mexico Tech over in Socorro, and they analyzed it with a scanning electron microscope, and they gave me some elemental stuff on it. And it came back as being a rather interesting alloy. Might have been an aircraft alloy, might have been unusual, just looking at the compositions of it. So I elected to have some magnesium isotopes done. And let me explain what that does. Magnesium isotopes are like a fingerprint. They will tell you where this stuff comes from. And it can tell you whether it came from the moon or whether it came from Mars or whether it came from some extraterrestrial, some other star someplace. It can even tell you what part of Earth that it came from. Did it come from out of Africa? Did it come from the ocean? Because we did a lot of mining both in Africa, and it can tell you, it can narrow down exactly where this stuff comes from. So I had some magnesium isotopes done through Evans Analytical. It's a EG&G. And I didn't tell them that it was Roswell stuff. I told them that it was crashed aircraft that I found, and I wanted to find out where the magnesium possibly came from. So they analyzed it for me. And when the results came back, I can't say that I was stunned. I was pretty close, but when it came back, I'm going, well, this signature is not, it's not Earth. It's someplace else. But then going back and looking at the data very carefully, because I took a lot of scientific flack on that, I looked at it, and what happened on that is the resolution of their instrument was not very high, and it was right at the margin of error. And I'm going, yeah, it's at the margin of error, but it's not dead center. It's on the outer margin. So I elected to have some more work done, and this is where some things got very interesting. Some arrangements were made with ASU, Arizona State University, and there was only three people that knew about the research that was made. It was myself, the lab technician, and the lab manager, and a geologist that set it up for me, who was also a UFO person. And so we made arrangements I wanted to hand deliver it, but I elected to send it out. I sent it to them. And this is another thing that I've learned to deal with now. You always take pictures of things. You always you document everything very, very well before you send it out. So I sent this material out FedEx. It was essentially double packaged. It was or triple packaged, and even tape was around the object. I put the object, my family saw it. My family saw me put the fragment of AH1 in the plastic container, and then it was all sealed up and sent FedEx. Well, when it arrived at the lab, I get this telephone call that said, where's the sample? And I'm going, the sample's in the plastic container that's inside the FedEx package. And the lab manager looked at it and said, well, there's a plastic container. The plastic container is all wrapped up with tape, but there's nothing in the plastic container. And I'm going, I put it in there. And then we started going through all the steps. She says, well, it sat in our shipping receiving area for a little bit more than an hour before I got it. And it got there and it was sent FedEx. They even paid for the FedEx shipment to go out there. What happened to that sample? I don't know. I blame them for it, because I think when they opened it up, a static might have lost it or something. This is another one of these things where I was putting the blame on them, ASU, and because of that, they said, "Oh, you know, we're not going to do anything for you again, because this made kind of a splash," and I should have just kept my mouth shut. But it was one of these things where I got pretty upset about it, because that was 30%, half of that specimen gone. And that is not a good thing, because that one was a very small specimen. To this day, I don't know what happened to that sample. It just completely disappeared. At least that's what the lab manager told me. And ASU was not happy with me for making a big stink about it, because I said it was their fault, when it may not have been their fault, but who knows. That was all over the internet, all over media that was available to me at the time, and it disappeared. I did have somebody email me. It was Alejandro Rojas. So Alejandro sent me an email, and he said, Frank, he says, did you know that you can open up a package using ultrasonics, and then you can seal it back up again, and nobody knows that you've gotten into it? And I'm going, really? And I did some research on that, and that's actually a fact. You can use some ultrasonics to open up packages, sound waves, and take the material out, seal it all back up again, and it doesn't even look like anybody's touched it. Way cool. Just adds to the conspiracy on this, and to this day, that package has the package is there, but the contents of it have disappeared. Now I'm careful. Now I either hand deliver the specimens, and it's always better to hand deliver and be present when analytical work is done to make sure that it's done the right way, and that there's no mistakes on it, because I know enough about it now so that I'll realize what goes on if there's mistakes. I have shipped some things out before, but it's all been photographed and documented by multiple people. So now I haven't lost anything since then, not a single thing. So that's the story behind that one.
Yeah. Very interesting, to say the least. Now, were there any other tests done, between that one and the one that I did in 2018? Had there been any other testing?
Yeah, there's one other isotope test that came out as being inconclusive. It's another one that didn't quite show up right, and it was essentially on that same specimen. Another one. So there was two tests done, and they weren't exact enough to get the answers. And then some of the other fragments have been analyzed, and they have come back as being granted. And I will admit to this, there was one or two pieces came back as being aluminum can material. That's easy to recognize because that stuff was found essentially on the surface, and it's very shiny. So the material that is found on the surface and is very shiny may have been trash, and how it got out there and shredded up into little pieces. I have some scientific speculation on that it was probably whipped up in cow feed or something, and the cows ate it and like essentially pooped it out. Don't know for sure. But the rest of this stuff, the old gray stuff, is different. It's thicker. It's not shiny. It's corroded aluminum, and it's been out there for a long time because it's been buried really, really deep. So, that's the, and anyway, getting back to the analytical work, some of it, like I said, a couple of pieces came back as being trash. I will admit to that. Where it came from, I don't know. But there are some people, great, there's people out there. There are some of the fragments that came back as being alloys that are mysterious, if you want to think of. In other words, I can't figure out what they are. Aircraft alloys, maybe how they got there, I don't know. There's also some unknown alloys. There's like a catalog. You can plug these chemistries into a catalog online, and it'll tell you what alloy that it's made out of, and what the designation of that alloy is. And some of the pieces are unknown alloys. Can we make them on Earth? Yeah, if we put the right chemistries together, we can make the stuff. But other than that, that's what I found.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let's fast forward to 2018, when I was working with this television production company, and we went out to the crash site with you. I think I have, I've got an image here. This is you bringing, Jennifer and I out there with your son. One of my bucket list moments of my entire life, Frank. That was just incredible. I will never, ever, ever forget that day. And you kind of ran us through, you know, why this was the site. You showed us the arroyos where the impact was. The area kind of where we're standing is where some of the debris was found. And you entrusted us to bring these somewhere to get some of these tested. And I'm just going to be frank. Frank in general. I'm going to be frank. I was extremely disappointed in not only the initial results given to us by the lab, but how the entire thing was handled. So I kind of want to walk through that with you, if you don't mind.
Sure,
going up to 2018, this is me holding one of the pieces that you showed me. And again, these materials were so light. It just astounded me. You know, when I was holding these, I just couldn't believe that whatever this was as light as a feather.
Inside this container, they are the material that I picked up out at the debris field. You can see how they're all twisted and mangled up. These specimens are untested, but these are some of the things that I would like to have some really good science done on these things.
Would you mind if we held them?
It's fine. Go ahead.
Sure.
You're not going to get some kind of disease off of them or anything.
This one, to me, is interesting. It looks like it's almost curled back. It's bent.
When metals are subjected to a lot of stress, they fold and bend and twist around. And not only that, they usually end up being small pieces with jagged edges, or the edges might be melted.
It seems to fit a scenario that something crashed at a high speed.
And that is the kind of thinking that I went on as well.
This is insanely light and very, very strong.
You're right. It's incredibly strong for its size.
But not only that, it was bent, it was curled back, which kind of deduced to my partner and I that whatever these things were under high stress and some sort of, you know, really extreme either heat or some sort of pressure or impact, if I'm not mistaken. Is that kind of what you deduced as
that
well?
That is true. Under a microscope, you can see that some of these have they're melted. Some of them have what are called explosive curling. So when you look at it, they're curled up. That looks like it's been like when you shoot a can or you shoot a piece of metal, as the bullet goes through, it kind of curls up on the backside. And this shows explosive curling. It also shows some rather interesting things. It shows explosive impacts. So there are several of these specimens that have holes punched through them. And these holes are generated by explosives. How do I know this? Or it's been through an explosive event, because it makes that same, when you flip it over, it's indented on one side, but on the other side, you can see where the whatever projectile was exited. It literally curls the metal back and folds it back on itself. So yeah, it's been through, for lack of a better term, a lot of these pieces have been through hell and back. So a little unusual.
Unusual, and does make you wonder, you know, had they been through some sort of explosion, which could mean a million things, but could also mean some sort of craft making an impact and essentially exploding. It could.
The Somewhere in the Skies podcast is free to listen to every week, but if you would like to help support the show, we have a very active Patreon page where you give what you think the show is worth. In return, you'll get early access to the main show, bonus episodes, and priority to ask our guests your listener questions. Your support truly makes the show continue and grow. So, to learn more and to join, visit patreon.com/somewhereskies.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I want to get to, you know, what we showed on the television show, which was very little. Again, something I wasn't too pleased with in terms of the work done by the lab that I worked with. And I'm not casting shade. They did what they did. It is what it is. I wish there was more due diligence and follow-up with that. But between you and I, we were able to get the results of the tests. Now in the show, we showed the two of the individuals who worked with us, very nice guys who did the tests, and it came back that most of it was just aluminum, which on the surface seems very normal, prosaic. But the further you dug into the actual results, the more it wasn't so simple. None of this ever is. So if you don't mind, Frank, I'm actually going to pull up the results that we got.
Oh, absolutely.
So this is one more image I'm going to show. This was Atlas Testing Laboratories.
This is where they had, this is where they were dissolving or had dissolved the specimens and they were getting ready to test it, which is what the little vials are for right there. That's the liquid itself that they did the testing on.
Yep. So I believe it was six samples we gave. Three were inconclusive due to organic material being found on them. Yeah, that was interesting. I didn't quite understand that. Could you demystify that for me? Logical explanation for that?
I can try to demystify that. So three of the samples came back. They said they couldn't analyze it because there was too much organic material. When they dissolved it, there was a bunch of organics that showed up in the liquid. So here's two scenarios on that. Number one, they didn't clean the samples because the samples were semi-clean out of the ground directly from me. So they should have cleaned them. They should have cleaned them with maybe alcohol or benzene or some kind of organic solvent just to clean the surface to get any contamination on them off. So possibility, the organics might have been from the site. Now, the other scary thing is that if the samples were cleaned and they dissolved them, that means there was organic material within the metallic structures, and that becomes a problem, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know of you know, the technology. This falls into the realm of essentially organometallic or organic metallic alloys, which exist, but why they would be out there, I don't know. And if the fact that they couldn't analyze them because there was organics tied up in that aluminum kind of alloy, that is pretty exotic. So it was either a legitimate mistake or it's something exotic, and now we have a mystery on our hands because we don't have any analytical data to go along with this because the samples were destroyed.
This is just me living in regret.
Oh, there you go. There you go. If you remember correctly, I said, hey, can we get the liquids back?
Right.
Never got the liquids back. And that's because they were considered hazardous materials. So they could not ship those liquidy things to us. And that is really tragic because we could have taken that liquid and had the liquid analyzed even further. So that would have been amazing if that could have been done. So that was, I wouldn't say fishy. It's just they're following the rules and regulations for analytical laboratories and through the mail system. But I think if it was sealed properly, they could have sent it through UPS or something ground. I would have gone over and picked it up by hand if that would have been the case, if they would have given it to us. So that's neither here nor there. Those are the only two scenarios. Either there was something really weird in the samples, or the samples were not cleaned properly before the test.
Got it. All right. Well, for the other three samples, we do have those results. So I'm going to go ahead and pull those up here. Give me one sec. See if I can do this. All right. There we go. We've got the official results here. And I kind of just want to run through this. There's four pages, Frank. Let me know what's important and what's not as I'm scanning here. I know it might be a little hard to see. Let me see if I can zoom this in.
There you go. That's good. Oh, now I can read it myself.
So I want to go ahead and start with the first page here that we see there. Is there anything interesting on those top results there of NH1 and DF31-5B?
Actually, there is. The one that's the N1-1, this just basically what it's showing is it shows the amount of molybdenum in there, which is was this particular one. We wanted to have it analyzed because there was this, some analytical work that was done at another lab showed a very high concentration of molybdenum. And this just basically showed that there wasn't 3% molybdenum in this. There was 0.004. So that lab, which was up in Canada, and I wasn't present during that analytical work on that. That was another documentary on another TV show. And this is what happens when a scientist, meaning myself, is not there to question the results as they come out. And it took me a while to get those results back. So there was no molybdenum in it, which means that they made errors, or basically made errors in their isotopic work that they did when they said it was terrestrial and not extraterrestrial in origin. Anytime you make a 3% error in the concentrations of stuff, that means your lab techniques are not very good. So anyway, so this was good. The N1-1, 98.6%, it just shows the major concentrations of elements. And then as we scroll down, there's more. And then the DF315B, once again, shows very little molybdenum in there, but it shows that it has a high aluminum concentration, 92.5. And then we kind of boil down. Now, this one is interesting. The one called MagStress. MagStress says 0.04 aluminum, 0.002 molybdenum. And this one was, the reason why it's called MagStress is because this was a piece of iron that I found buried 3 or 4 inches deep. No rust on it, not a speck of rust. Something buried in the ground that long should be rusty. This thing was not rusty. So we analyzed this, and when we scroll down, I'll tell you there was a problem with this when they analyzed it. Now, here's the other part. SH1 couldn't be analyzed. That was the one that was really weird because SH1 was, that's the top one on this. SH1 yeah. was one that we were looking for molybdenum. They didn't study it. Roswell sink, once again, organic material and untested, could not be analyzed with their because of organic material. They basically, the lab said that they couldn't touch these because the organics would clog up their little atomizer nozzles that they had, and they couldn't do it. The rest of this is just they were using the National Institute of Standards traceable elements in that as a standard to compare against.
Okay, gotcha.
Let's now comes the fun part.
Okay, yeah, this is the page I was looking forward to. Now we really get in the weeds of what was found in these.
Yeah, and N1, the N1 sample, 0.05 copper, 0.5% iron, small amounts of gallium, more than 0.5% of magnesium, some manganese in there, nothing in nickel, silicon, it's got 0.29 silicon. The rest of this is sort of insignificant that's in there because it's very small. They basically came back and, back up to this.
Oh, sorry.
Scroll back up. Here we go.
Yeah.
They said that this was basically a 3004 aluminum alloy, similar to a 1100. They were wrong on that. Because I sent this over to, I sent this data over to, they used to be Alcoa, and I had one of their, they've changed their name because the business changed. So Alcoa is a aluminum manufacturing company, and they make all kinds of alloys. And I had those people looked at it. They says, well, no, this is not a 1100 series alloy, and it's not a 3004 alloy. And they gave me some examples of what it might be. So they were wrong on this. A 3004 is definitely an aluminum can. So, but it doesn't match an aluminum can, and so it's not an aluminum can alloy. It's basically end up being kind of an unknown alloy. We have no idea what it is. Could we make it here on Earth? Yeah, we could make it, but it's an alloy that is not common. And that's what it basically come out to when I did more research on it.
Interesting. Now, when you did that research and you said, you know, it could be made here, but what would it, would something of that series, that high of a series, I guess, what would that be made for, if I could
ask? It's not even a 1000 series alloy. It's something else. 1000 series are used for pie plates and basically aluminum foil. So they were completely wrong on that, because to say that it's a 304 aluminum and that it is a 1100 is the two don't even match. You can't even put those in the same area. So they were wrong on this, and I caught that real quick. So
right. I remember getting the voicemail from you.
Yeah, that was the interpretation. That's the one I got rather hot about on that. I'm going, yeah, these guys are all washed up. They have no idea what they're talking about. So
let's see.
Okay, now
anything
this one
interesting
was,
here?
Yeah, this one was interesting. This one, you know, one of these, this one came out as Bing, and I don't have that. I don't have that. I made a graph, and I, you know what I should do is, Brian, is I'm going to send the graph to you where it compares these things.
Oh, great.
You don't have that graph. I'm going to send that graph, and that graph actually compares, some known things to some unknown things. And it's a very colorful graph done with, as soon as we get done with this, I'll send it out to you.
Okay.
Because to try to explain what's going on here, this was another one that basically ended up being kind of an unusual alloy. So it might be an aircraft alloy of some kind. Don't know why it's out there. I don't know. But this was another one that was, scroll up a little bit and let me see what they said it was on this one. Ah, they didn't have any information. You can just keep going down on this.
Okay.
So this one was, So this one ended up, let me see what they got. Now this one, they were correct on this. So I stand corrected on this. This was a 3004 alloy, but notice they compared it against a 3004 aluminum standard and it matched. However, the 1100 series and a 304 doesn't match. So this one, I will admit to the fact that this one was in fact similar to a 3004 alloy, which is used for the sides of aluminum cans. That's what it's used for. That will I admit to. This one, they did right.
Okay.
The other one, the 1100 series, wasn't right. But when you look at these, like I said before, and I'm not trying to hide anything or allude to anything. There are three or four different kinds of material out there. Some of it is bright and shiny, and that's modern stuff. The stuff that's buried is the stuff that's really old. The mag stress. This one, do the math. Take 88.9% iron and add in all of this. Where's the rest of it? That's all I've got to say. Do the math on this.
Interesting.
Something is not right with this. I have no idea where the rest of this is, but you know, anytime you weigh up this, it should be really, really close to 100%. Might be 98 or 99, but if you do the math on this, I don't think this comes any. I mean, look at the numbers. You've got 88.9 iron. The rest of these are really tiny. The other one is 0.7. Okay, so that takes us up to 90, give or take a little bit. 0.3, yeah. They did something wrong on this because it doesn't add up. It's not there. So the results on this were bogus, completely bogus.
Okay. And see, like, this is a learning process for me because I, you know, going into this project, like I was told this was a very prominent metal testing lab, and I'm sure they have done great work in the past. However, it seems like they did make a lot of kind of amateurish mistakes going into this. I don't know. What do you think?
One of them was not cleaning the material. And granted, some of this stuff was folded over, but they could have unfolded it. They could have stuck it in some like organic solvents to, it's not going to hurt the metals any, to get rid of that surface stuff that's on it. They could have been careful. The one that's really disturbing is this iron one. This iron one just doesn't match. So they put wrong numbers in there. And I don't know why. I mean, it's pretty easy. Anybody that looks at this, you can add up all these numbers. They do not come out to anywhere near, not even 95%. I don't think it comes out to even 95%. So where's the missing percentages of this? It's all gone.
Right.
So it's a big chunk that's missing. So we're missing data on this.
Interesting.
Either that or I'm missing something. Look at it yourself. I mean, you can just glance at it. I know the math. 80, we're talking 89% roughly, and then add up all those small numbers, and they don't even come anywhere near 95 or 100, not even close to it.
Hmm. Right. And whatever those other numbers are, what are they, is the real question too.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I don't know what the others are. It could be all the rest of the elements. If they are, what elements are making this up? You know, we've got copper, we've got iron, we've got nickel and silicon and titanium. There could be carbon in it. If this was a high carbon steel, there could have been quite a bit of carbon sitting in there, but they should have noted that. Of course, then they would have come back and said there was organics in there, which would have been weird. So I don't know. There's some stuff missing on this. And like I said, the missing stuff is intriguing. It doesn't have anything here that is just looking at it, because I've looked at a lot of being a geologist, I've sort of turned into a metallurgist, a well as well, looking over this material and the concentrations of stuff. There's, like I said, there's stuff missing on this, but there's nothing in this that, looking at it the way it stands, there's nothing in it that's unusual. So, you know, it should have small amounts of copper. It should have, of course, it should have large amounts of iron. It's going to have some silicon in it. So it's unknown to me. I have no idea what they did on this.
Okay.
Mystery.
It's a mystery. Yep. And you know, I take a good portion of responsibility for that. And I just wanted to kind of clear the air on that, because I think a lot of people were bummed when, like, we didn't find, interstellar spacecraft.
But you know, these production companies have a budget, and I wish that, and this is what I wish upon any production company that I deal with, I wish that I could have gone there and witnessed what was going on, because I would have caught the things that are going. Same thing happened with the material that was sent to Trent University during another show, not one that we were on, but a different one that was through the Discovery Channel. They made mistakes up there, and I would have caught those mistakes firsthand if I would have been there to see what was going on. So this is why somebody with some scientific knowledge needs to be there. Now, I will have to mention this. Bless their hearts. Ancient Aliens. All right. So they, on their Relics of Roswell, I'm going to have to say that they did good work. Good analytical work, except the really sad part about that is they left out some of the best parts. It would have extended the show and would have made some interesting things, but they did some good work on that. And I was there when they did a majority of it, and the rest of it was done off-site, but the off-site work was through a trusted friend, not mine, but the gentleman that did the original analytical work, which was Thetaplate. Name of the company. They are a plating company. He's got some nice equipment for analyzing stuff, because he does government contract work. His good friend did the work on it, and I've got the analysis back. But some of the cool things that they found, they didn't talk about. There was barium found in some of the samples. And the barium,
what is that?
It's an element. You know, it's similar to the barium, you know, when people do like barium enemas or whatever, or swallow barium to have their intestines looked at for x-rays. Barium is very heavy. But barium is also a byproduct of nuclear testing. And the interesting thing is several of the samples had a relatively high barium content. And the cool thing about that is, even if it was not part of the alloy itself, it would indicate that the metals came from the time frame of the, it might have been a fallout that was left on the ground. So it came from somewhere near the same level, or not level. In other words, it got contaminated from fallout from our first nuclear test, which would be significant because then that would help to date the material sometime closer to the crash event. So that's why it sparked as being, and they found some other things too. They also found some weird silicon tubes and stuff under the SEM, and they even admitted that it had been through an explosion. I'm going, what the heck is this stuff? They didn't really talk too much about that part. They left it out, which was sad. They should have done more work on it. But they did good work. What they had, they just didn't do enough. But they sent it all to me, every scrap of it.
There you go. Hey, that's all you could ever ask for. God bless. I was talking to Giorgio, actually, right before we got on here, Frank. And he
was Giorgio.
So excited to hear that I was interviewing you. So he sends his best. I got to watch a little bit of that before we got on here. And they did really good work. So I definitely give them credit for that.
You know, people out there in the UFO community have a tendency to sometimes bash ancient aliens. But you know what? If they have the right person telling them the right direction to go in, they do good research on some stuff. Say what you want. I was impressed by what they did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, okay. I guess, Frank, I do have some really good listener questions for you.
I'd love these. Really,
yeah.
Sometimes they catch me off guard. I'm waiting for that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to get to those. Two last things I want to ask you before we get to those, however.
Sure.
The first one being, with all of the materials you've had tested, you know, even the ones that we worked with, Atlas Lab and everything, what do you think is the most compelling or intriguing thing that has been, you know, uncovered so far with all of the metals? Does anything really stand out to you as highly anomalous?
I think you know, being a scientist, I cannot come out and say I have extraterrestrial material in my hand. I can't do that because you need to have, in order for something to come out right, you need to have three independent laboratories that are good laboratories confirm the exact same information across the board. I've never been able to have that done. We get onesies, maybe twosies, but not the third one. And it's usually something goes wrong or things disappear or whatever. And it gets to be kind of scary on that. So here's what I've got. I have material that is odd. It's anomalous. Does it have the magical properties that people, the Holy Grail, where you like, you know, hold it in your hand and let it unfold? No, it doesn't have that. Do we have some things that are intriguing as far as metals that are sitting out in the desert? Yeah, we do. They are intriguing things. Some of them are different in that they're essentially unknown types of they're unknown alloys. But once again, they can be made on Earth. They're just different combinations of elements, and it might have been errors in the work that was done on it previously, but some of the work was really good. So it's still a mystery in that I would like to say, yeah, these are extraterrestrial in origin. But mainstream science needs to look at this stuff, and they need to look at it very carefully and say, hey, yeah, you know, you've got trash from out there, or you've got ET material out there, or you have pieces of stuff from airplanes that blew up in the sky or something. People need to look at it, not just a geologist that works at a local school in Roswell. You need to have some good scientific evaluations of this material, and that has not been done yet.
That's fair enough, man. I love that. That's, again, a responsible answer. Okay. So in terms of new stuff, new discoveries, within the last few weeks, you've been out to the site with a fellow colleague of ours, Chuck Zukowski, actually. Yes. And tell us how that experience was. We found more stuff. Is this correct?
You know, this was a whole crazy trip. And when I mean crazy, it was, for one thing, it was dead quiet out there. There wasn't any noise, very little breeze. I think the breeze was like maybe 5 miles an hour at the most. And I know that because there was a Chuck was flying, trying to fly his drone, and I'll get to that story. And he did fly it eventually, but started looking for things out there and had problems with what's called the ground balance on the metal detector. So the ground balance is that it's the ground makes a lot of noise, and it's, I call it static, and you can correct for that. So I had to manually correct for static more so than I've ever done before. The ground, it probably had rained a few days before, because once you get down about 3 or 4 inches, the ground was a little damp, not wet, it was just damp. And that every time the ground has been damp out there, I've actually found material. However, looked around for a while and we found some stuff. We found two metal fragments spaced probably 2-3 feet apart, buried once again a couple inches deep. This is a picture of one of them right here. But here is the ground balance thing was bugging me. So digging this stuff up was pretty exciting. Directly behind where you see the truck up on the ridge over there, there was an interview that lasted maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And the camera guys, basically they hadn't turned their cameras on. This was new. The batteries were brand spanking new and they mentioned this afterwards, but we went up to film, and during the interview part of this, not one, but if I remember correctly, two cameras failed simultaneously. The batteries drained and they were gone. Mm-hmm. And as we were walking back, they said, we're going to have to reshoot this because we lost information. We lost film. And I'm going, well, this is crazy. And LA was with us, and he's the gentleman standing there with the light colored cap on. And he basically said that, no, we got the material that we needed for the film. But it was just, that was strange. So we started walking towards where the buttons were found, and we walked and there was one camera rolling and they had audio on and everything. And we were walking out direction of where the buttons are, and about 2/3 of the way to the buttons, the camera guy goes, we lost all audio. It's gone. And I'm going, what? And they said, yeah, the audio is gone. And they lost audio until we got to where the buttons were located. And then the audio came back on. And he had marked the area where the audio loss was. And then we went back and there was no problem with it. So Chuck had a tri-field meter, and a tri-field meter shows magnetic fields. It shows electromagnetism. It shows all kinds of things, but it shows three. It shows magnetism, it shows electrostatics, and it shows one other thing. It's just called a tri-field meter. The ghost hunters use it a lot. It's a nice meter. And he says, hey, Frank, take this and just kind of walk around and see what you find. So I was walking around, and that thing was doing bizarre stuff. It would be all quiet, and then it would make a jump. A real jump over to, it's got a scale from 1 to 100, but it would make a jump to 10. And then like instantly, almost within the blink of an eye, and then it would go back down, and then it would creep up to maybe like onesies or twosies, and it would stay there for a little bit, and then we'd go back down. And while I'm doing this, Chuck is trying to get his drone to fly. And he says, I can't get the drone to start. So I'm going, what? He says, no, the drone will not start. I can't get it to fly. Eventually it did fly. So between the tri-field meter stuff and the ground balancing and the missing, I've never had experience that out there. It was bizarre, to say the least. And I'm an open-minded scientist. I'm going, you know what, this is, to have all this electronic stuff going on out here is strange. Mm-hmm. I've never had it happen before, although I've had the ground balance issues out there before. So I don't know. Maybe it was all the rains that that caused some disturbances, or maybe there was something going on. It was odd. It even felt odd, which was kind of interesting for me, because my son's been out there with me before. He won't go out there anymore because he said that it creeps him out because he gets odd feelings. Well, when I was out there this time, I got odd feelings like I haven't had before. So I'm going, all right, this is strange. I don't know why it was doing that. Maybe it was alien ghosts or something. I have no idea, but it was a very strange day. It was a fun day. Professional film crew that's out there, I can't wait to see this. It's a little documentary that's going to come out here probably in August. And I can't wait to see it, because it was done very, very well. And they got the discovery of the metal on film, which is only the second time that that's ever happened. So it's all very, very well documented, and even some talk about the strangeness that was going on out there. And it was all shot live. So I'm going, this is pretty wild. So I'm hoping I'm not disclosing any too much of anything on this, but it was an amazing trip that was out there, and we found two pieces of metal. Now, as far as analytical work, I'm trying to get in touch with some labs right now. They have not responded to me, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of times when I make requests, they don't respond, and I have to send out multiple, sometimes even have to call up. Sometimes they won't respond, but usually the universities are good. So I'm trying to contact universities to have the work done, because they do some of the best. And if worse comes to worse, I will contact the folks that did some work with Ancient Aliens, and I'll say, hey, how about analyzing this for me? And I'm sure they'll be glad to do it, and they won't charge me much. But I wanted to get a university to look at it.
Awesome.
That's where it stands.
Well,
nothing earth shattering yet, although this is the piece that you see here is one of the two pieces that were found. I found them both, and that looks identical to this one's really dirty. I hasn't been cleaned up. That's what it looks like when it comes out of the ground. It was buried 2-3 inches deep. Lots of ground balancing static all in the area, like I said, but it was a fun day, and I didn't expect to find anything at all. So this was kind of a neat little discovery out there. More things to be found.
Exactly. More things to be found and analyzed. That's all we can really ask for at this point. Awesome, man. Well, hey, let's move to these listener questions. You know, I promised you we wouldn't be here for 4 hours like Coast to Coast AM, as much as I admire their work over there. But I do want to get you out of here. 4 hours is good. I know we could talk for 4 hours on or off camera. Let's start with this listener question from Ryan on Facebook. And he asks, have any of the pieces you found been looked at by Gary Nolan? And if so, what did he make of them? Have you ever worked with Dr. Gary Nolan?
No, I have not worked with Nolan. And as far as I know, he has not looked at this material at all. I don't even know. I don't even recognize the name. If I did, maybe it's my COVID brain cells that are short-circuited or something, but I don't remember the name at all.
Okay, that's fair. I know he worked on some materials with Jacques Vallée and possibly to the Stars Academy when they were still.
Oh, in which case, no, but I can tell you that Hal Putoff looked at some of this material early on. Basically, the answers that I got back for them were kind of sketchy and inconclusive, so I didn't trust the results that I got back. It wasn't to the Stars, that was Hal Putoff that did the work at his Earth Tech lab. Didn't like the analytical work that was done. They had an error. Hard to explain. I don't think they did it right, but later on when I got the isotopes back, Hal Putoff contacted me and said, hey, if you want to get some more work done, I'll pay for it. I never followed up. I hate to say this, didn't trust him at the time. So,
interesting.
God's honest truth. So that's where that stands.
That's fair. That's fair. Okay. Eric on Twitter asks, why was there remaining evidence? Oh, this is a good question. Eric says, why was there remaining evidence to begin with? with. We kind of covered that in terms of why there would still be stuff out there.
You know, it's interesting thing. All right, so the story behind Roswell and the recovery, many days, military basically walking side by side. Some of them, according to the stories, on their hands and knees, just crawling across, crisscrossing this ground multiple times, picking up every single thing that they could possibly find, putting it in a bag. You know, if it doesn't move, put it in a bag. I think that's Don Schmidt mentions that a lot in his thing. So yeah, they picked up everything that was laying on the surface that they could see. Now the issue at hand comes with a typical crash site, is that there are there's probably tens of thousands of tiny little pieces that, like I said, get washed into the burrow holes, get carried away, blown in the wind or whatever, and recycled. Now, it was raining out there and it was storming at the time that this took place. And so I suspect that a lot of the smaller stuff was washed away. And the only way the government could have gotten it all is that they would have gone in here and scooped up a quarter of a mile of land and maybe a foot deep and carted it all off. That I didn't see. So they did the best they could with what they had, and they could not have gotten all of the little pieces. There are little pieces left out there. Still need some work done on it.
That's fair. All right. Last listener question here, Frank. UFO Detective on Twitter asks, if you ever found a piece of a craft that verifiably is alien, what would be the strategy for informing the public, and how would you stop the government from taking it and keeping it as a secret?
It's a good question. These days, if you keep stuff like that secret, it's going to you're liable to lose it. The absolute best thing to do is to contact the media instantaneously, get press releases, get the newspaper, get the media, get everybody, get YouTube, get you, get all of the UFO people in the world jumping on the bad wagon and shove it all out on the media as fast as possible. Get the information out there as quick as you can. You got to be one step above anybody that might want to take the material. So yeah, if I had, let's say I was to find a piece of that wonderful material that folds up and then unfolds in your hand, that would be an instantaneous in the media as fast as absolutely possible. And that's the way to deal with this. If you beat around the bush, things are liable to get confiscated. Maybe not. But basically, you need to open your big mouth and run with it on that case. That's exactly what you need to do. It's my honest opinion.
I love it. I love it, man. Well, that kind of brings us to literally today, the last few days. We had this explosive story come out in the media, first through the Debrief, a tech news website, and also through News Nation and the investigative journalist Ross Coulthard. And they sort of simultaneously came out with a story of this gentleman, David Grush, who is now being coined a military whistleblower, who was given information about UFO crash retrieval programs that have been going on for even earlier than 1947. So before I get to the Roswell question of that, what did you make of this when this information first came forward, Frank? What was your sort of knee-jerk reaction, and where do you stand right now on that entire story? It's crazy if any of this is actually true.
You know what? The very first time I saw that, and I'm going, oh, yeah, I like that. I like the knee-jerk thing because, you know, I have a tendency to jump the gun on a lot of things. I says, oh, great. Here's another one of these things where there's no proof, no pictures, no video, no nothing whatsoever. And I even mentioned that on a couple of Facebook posts. And then I thought about this for a little while, and I'm going, you know what? I said, this guy's got a lot of guts. Not only does he have guts, but we need more people like him to come forward and basically tell the public what's going on. Because the more people like the whistleblowers that come out, that have verifiable credentials, that have seen this stuff, that know about what the government is doing, we need more of those people to come forward and to talk about this without people coming back and saying, oh yeah, you know, show me a piece of it. And that was my very first reaction. But when I got to thinking about what this gentleman had gone through, I'm going, okay, you know what? This is pretty amazing, pretty startling stuff. And we need more like him out there to come forward. On that note, speaking of Roswell, real quick, I'll mention this. You know, Ryan, a lot of people back, and people still do this today, when they go on vacations, when they find little trinkets, they stick them in their jewelry box. They stash it away, little bits of pieces. I mean, it used to be people, oh, I have a little piece of a mummy from Egypt, or I have some sand from whatever. You know what? I'm gonna take a wild guess that there's some people out there that could very well have some fragments of the Roswell crash that are sitting in their jewelry box that they've never disclosed for fear that they would get shot or killed or drug out into the desert or something like that. And they probably show it to family members and things like that. I'd love it if those people would come forward with this stuff and say, hey, you know what? This is what sits in my jewelry box. I would love that. That would just delight me to no end.
Absolutely. You know, and there have been those rumors that Jesse Marcel had some stuff stashed away in his house. God knows if that's true or if we'll ever see it. But talk about, like, you know, OG original whistleblowers. That was definitely one of them. For sure. But
yeah, well, so these, you know, the whistleblowers, yeah. we need to have more like them. And they need to come forward. They need to do this. You know, I don't have any books out there. And, you know, a lot of people don't know who I am, except within the UFO community. People know who I'm at because I do good research. At least I think I do good research on this. No books. I have lots of little documentaries out there and such, which I dearly enjoy doing, and things like this. And I give talks and stuff like that. But, you know, it's the people that are going to make a difference are like the whistleblower that came forward. And there's been a couple of those that are out there, and they need to speak up. They need to do that because, you know, the people of the world need to know this. Think of the technology. You know, we always like to go on the premise of national security, but think of the energy sector. Think of what it would do to society. They're going to say, yeah, it could disrupt society, but I don't think so. I think it would propel us into the time frames of like Star Trek or something like that. Maybe I'm a dreamer or whatever. But, you know, it all started in that in the Star Trek movie First Contact, where the Vulcans landed. And that's what started our whole exploration of space, was that deep space. Because, you know, hey, they saw our signature from our first warp drive. So and then they shared all their technology with us because they knew that we were ready for it. I think we're ready for a lot of things. And I think we need to do that. If we could just take enough time to stop fighting with each other on the planet, pay attention to some stuff that's going on out there, I think it would delight the world. I think it would make it a much better place than it is right now.
Absolutely. I could not agree with you more on that, man. Well, in terms of this story and Roswell, so this David Grush, he claims that at least 12 UFO crashes and retrievals that he's aware of intact or partially intact craft have occurred. And he was asked by Ross Coulthart, when asked if one of those was Roswell, this was the exchange. Coulthart said, "What can you tell me about the Roswell craft?" Grush said, "Unfortunately, those details were not approved for me to talk about right now." Coulthart said, "It seems ridiculous to me how the U.S. Air Force changed its story." Grush said, "Yeah, and they added additional elements over time and tried to conflate additional programs to explain some of these events." So what do you make of these, Frank? A lot of people want to know, why can't he talk about Roswell?
Well, he doesn't know. And this is like speculation on my part. He does know that the government will expand things and hide things. He knows that. And he mentioned that. He was very careful about his wording on that. So he may not know, but he knows that there was stuff that was covered up, and he knows that. And that's the exciting part about the information that he gave, that he could give out, that he knew about. I think it was honest about what he said. He basically made it known. He says, yeah, you know, the government hides things and the government tries to twist the truth around. And that's what they do and call it to protect national security. He may not have mentioned that specifically, but that's what they do that for. And he was just laying out the facts that the Roswell information has been distorted and contorted over the years. And it was essentially manufactured by the government, not the crash itself, but the stories that come out and what they found, which was they found stuff, but they covered up as fast as they could. That's my take on it.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. Well, that kind of that flows right into kind of my last two-pronged question for you, Frank. The first being, what do you personally, as Frank Kimbler, believe crashed in Roswell in 1947? And on top of that, do you think we will ever truly know, the public will ever truly know what that was?
Okay, so what crashed in Roswell, it was something of unknown origin. We didn't know where it came from. So, you know what, let's take a look. I'm very open-minded. It could have been extraterrestrial, could have been interdimensional, which is always an interesting story on that. So something crashed out there, something unusual, and the government covered up. That's my thoughts on this. And I have no other, I don't think anyone can convince me otherwise that it was not something unusual that crashed out here. ET, interdimensional, maybe it was from our future, who knows? Mystery to me. Something got our people riled up, our government people riled up, and that's the story behind that. And then will we ever uncover? I think we will. I think if we have sufficient evidence right now, just in testimonies alone, that would actually hold up in a court of law about people that have said, hey, you know, something crashed out there. The government did this. The government did that. So that would actually hold up. The testimony would hold up. And I think it would hold up very strong. And I think that Roswell, the future of it is, it'll come out. You know, I think everybody's dead now that had something to do with the original crash, at least the vast majority. So now we're getting secondhand and third-hand accounts of what happened that's passed down from generation to generation. But now I think is the time to for that information to be let out. I'd like to see it all let out. I really would. I think the population of the world is ready for it, and I think Roswell is one of those things that if it's not Roswell, it could be other ones that are out there that we know about. And so, crash retrievals, crash recovery. I think that that we should disclose the information, and then people have been asking for that for a long time. It's coming. It seems to be fed to us a little bit at a time. I mean, with the Tic Tacs and those cool videos that are out there, that those were. And when I first saw those, I'm going, okay, this one's gonna be a little bit hard to just blow off. Okay, you just can't do that. We've got stuff that basically stumps our pilots and stumps our military, and we don't know what the heck it is. And yeah, that's the bona fide truth on that. So proof is in the pudding. I love proof like that.
Yep. It seems like we're entering a new phase, man, of acknowledgement that there are UFO crash retrieval programs, and that hopefully we'll find the truth behind some of these. And I think you're right. I think the public is ready and can handle the truth of what these things are. We've been through a lot in the world, especially in the past few years. I think we can handle anything that could possibly benefit humanity and give us a greater understanding of kind of where we lay in this cosmic agenda, I guess. So I look forward, just as you do, to hopefully more of these whistleblowers coming forward, feeling empowered to do that and to show that, you know, the truth will out someday, somehow, and maybe it'll be within your lifetime and my lifetime.
Oh, I would love, one can only hope. Absolutely love to see it. Would love to see it in my lifetime, just to say, knew it. Okay, that's cool.
Exactly, man. Hey, let's leave on that hopeful note. The future looks bright. I can't wait to see what comes of the new metals that you guys found out there. Hopefully we'll get those tests and analysis done. I just want to say, you know, no matter what happened with the results of the tests we had done, working with you was one of the greatest pleasures of my life. You gave us a tour of the International UFO Museum. I got to see where you work. You brought me to the UFO, one of the mecca of UFO sites. It was just an incredible few days that will literally stay with me until my dying day. So no matter what was found out there, what it is, what it isn't, it enriched my life more than I could possibly ever convey on a stupid television show. So I do want to thank you for giving me that opportunity and trusting me with that. And I want to thank you for coming on Somewhere in the Skies today. So yeah, if you have any last words, please.
My pleasure. I enjoyed working with you, Brian. I really have. And I freely share whatever I know. Anybody that asks, I give it to them. Same to you, same to everybody else. So Godspeed. That's all I can say on that one. So thank you very Absolutely. Much for your kind words.
Thanks, Frank. And for any of our listeners or viewers who might want to reach out to you, is that something you're willing to give any contact information for?
Oh, no, that's fine. You know what? I'm open to that. If they just don't like blow me out of the water, they can go through Facebook Messenger. That's fine. That's always kind of a safe way to go. Or we can sometimes I'm a little reluctant to give out emails, but people can find my email easy enough if they want to. So, you know, I'm out on Facebook. You can message me and it'll come through and I'll see it. And I'll say, okay, that's probably the safer way to go. Otherwise, who knows what kinds of things that'll come in. I mean, it's easy to get emails. People can, since they know I work at the New Mexico Military Institute, I should just give it out because they can contact me there as well. But my information is out there. But, you know, go through Messenger and Facebook. I mean, you've done that. Everybody's done that. It works. And it's kind of a safe way to go without divulging everything. Then I would say, oh, this looks like a pretty flaky person. I can just kind of know.
Absolutely. And guys, if you want to reach out to me, I'd always be willing to relay something to Frank if you need as well. If you have any leads on crash debris or people he can speak to or even laboratories that would be willing to work with him, reach out to me. I'll reach out to Frank. Let's work together on all of this. That's what I always tell people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The way to go. All right, my friend, I'm going to say goodnight. Thank you so much for your time tonight, and thank you for joining me on Somewhere in the Skies.
My pleasure.
Somewhere in the Skies is produced by Third Kind Productions in association with the Entertainment One Podcast Network.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.